a Motorsport Podcast Network production.
G'day everybody, Aaron Noonan here. Great to have you with me. It is the V8 Sleuth Podcast powered by Repco for another week. And this week we're wrapping up a two-part episode with stories from inside the Holden Racing Team during their golden era. But before we get to that, I've got to remind you too, the Castrol Motorsport News podcast every Tuesday for the latest in world and Australian motorsport with Andrew Van Leeuwen and Stefan Bartholomaeus. The boys recently picked up the Supercars Media Award for Best Podcast of the Year. We're very proud of them because we produce that program. Listen every Tuesday, subscribe so you don't miss an episode for all of that. Now, before we get stuck in this podcast too, if you're a Holden Racing Team fan, and there's a fair chance you are because you're listening to one about HRT's golden era, the Cars History Book 2nd Edition is available to pre-order now. It'll be out in the next few months. It's 400 pages, hardcover, limited edition, all numbered, documenting every car from the Holden Racing Team to race for the team from 1989 to 2016. There's 45 cars. It's updated with a whole pile of photos that were not in the first edition, a whole pile of information that wasn't in the first edition because there's been plenty going on with a lot of those cars in the last 4 or 5 years. It's a limited edition book. It's a must-have if you're a Holden fan. Jump on our website, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. Make sure you don't miss out because these books do sell out. Now, to this week's episode. My guest is Paul Wally Weissel, and he was the HRT media man from 1994 to 2004. In part two, he tells us about a bunch of stuff, including about how he buried a huge story about Craig Lowndes injuring himself a week out from Bathurst in 1996, the controversy around Peter Brock's 1994 Bathurst Commodore, and why Wall is still mad about it. And I didn't think we were going to go down that pathway, but I asked the question and away he went. Have a listen. He really does light up. And he also talks about how Mark Scaife started to win over the team from when he walked in the door. And of course, plenty, plenty more, as is the case from inside the Holden Racing Team in a golden era. So here we go. Buckle up. Time to start part two of the pod on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco as we take a look at inside stories from the Holden Racing Team's golden era. These days, media management, being a PR manager for a race team, we're in a social media world. You know, teams now, you know, back in your day, I remember vividly when I first turned up in the late 90s as a kid at Calder and starting to do Formula Ford races for Motorsport News, you'd have the little table in the corner of the media room where you'd have your lovely – I loved your press kits. They were just the best because you put the chassis numbers into the cars. That's the early sleuthing. It's partly your fault. But teams and categories would have their little press packs with little folders and a couple of photos inside or the printed bits of paper with the preview of that round and here's the driver bios and here's the specs of the car and all that stuff, whereas now everything's electronic, everything's around. And a team wants to announce something, they'll fire a quick media release out via email or post it on social media and then everyone's scrambling to write about it straight away. Different world to, you know, what we're talking about here. So keeping secrets is hard, because people have these things called phones and they've got cameras in them. So in 1996, Walt, this call that says, tell me about this call when Lowndes falls off a motorbike a week or so before Bathurst.
1 week. Saturday.
Who makes the call? How do you get it? How do you go? Give me media management 101 when the superstar driver that everyone wants to know about, who's about to go for Bathurst, is the reigning champ, has gone and sconed himself off a motocross bike in a
sans helmet.
Without a helmet. Yeah, that's the other bit. off a curb, and he's gone and donged his head. What is the golden rules of media management here, circa 1996?
We had Lowndesy teed up to go on Channel 7's Sports Sunday or Sports World.
Sports World with Bruce.
With Bruce and that lot. And he was to go on air on the Sunday morning, the week out from Bathurst, and do a Craig the camera piece, how are you going? Yep, blah, blah, blah. I got a phone call about 8 or 9 o'clock from Jeff.
Sunday morning
from Jeff Gregg. Wally? Yes, Jeff.
Oh, that fucking idiot's done.
Which idiot are we talking of? There's quite a few.
Lowndes.
I said, what? He said,
idiot's fallen off a motorbike.
What do you mean he's fallen off a motorbike?
He's on a motorbike.
No, it wasn't. I didn't find out later that he was riding a motorbike with not appropriate clothing on, with no helmet on, and went to, as you say, jumper gutter on the thing and got pitched off and landed on his head. And I said, is he all right? Oh, I don't know. Might have concussion. I said, oh, God. He said, more to the point. He said, no one's to know. I said, obviously. But he's due to be on Channel 7 this morning. I said, yes. He said, so cancel it. Week out from Bathurst, you've got one of the biggest sporting shows
shows
in the country. And I thought, okay. And I can't even remember which lie I used to when I rang up Channel 7.
One of the go-tos
that he's not well, whether it's food poisoning or something or blah, blah, blah. Yeah, well, can we go out there? No, you can't go out there. No, he's just not, no, it might be contagious or whatever. Look, I'm sorry. You can't do it. Don't do it. Okay. So then became the subterfuge during the week following, and to the point where we don't even know if he's going to go to Bathurst because the docs are going, oh, concussion, I'm concerned about concussion unless there's some improvement over the next few days. So we used to travel up there on – I used to go up usually about Tuesday. And then we'd sort of even the drivers, et cetera, would come on Wednesday and blah, blah, blah. So Wednesday come and we do the Bathurst thingo in the main street where you sign autographs and blah, blah. No, Craig. Oh, no, touch of the flu. He'll be here soon. And, you know, we're sitting there crossing our fingers. And then he finally, got there Wednesday night. They'd given the all clear. But then, of course, he got a bit of a hole in his head where he sort of landed on the noggin. So we had to make sure everywhere he went he had a cap on his head. So which covered the knock. Now, your old boss, Chris Lambden, got a sniff of this.
From Motorsport News.
Yes, from Motorsport News. And Paul Gover from the News Limited, Herald Sun, Telegraph, et cetera, also had a sniff of it and knew something was going on. And so we had this tag thing going that when he pulled up in the pits to get out of the car – that basically, you know, Jeff would be leaning on the car. Well, how's the car? And I'd be leaning on the car listening to him and saying, and there's your cap. And the helmet would come off the car. And the cap would go on.
Before he slid out of the thing.
And they're looking at me, they're going, well, you know, something's going on here. And we're hearing rumours. No, mate, no, nothing. How's the car, Craig? Yeah, good, yeah. Any issue? No issues. And we thought, oh, God, here we go. Someone's going to break this. And then if he'd lost... If they hadn't won on the Sunday, you guarantee it would have been all over the media on the Monday.
So did you grab these guys and stop them?
We never admitted to it.
Kept going.
And they knew what was going on, they think.
But they didn't have enough to go with it.
No, because they couldn't get a shot. And they're all sitting there having their cameraman saying, get a shot of his head. We heard that. There's a possibility of that. And so we're doing this big cover-up thing with the cap on. And as I said, if they hadn't won the race on the Sunday, it would have been all over the papers and the media on the Monday. But because they won, Gover and Chris Lander went, okay, you got away with that, didn't you?
Take it off.
Yep, thanks very much. Yeah. So,
Was there, do you remember... Because I've heard the story that he was touch and go earlier in the week, that he had an arm arm and it was all, the nerves were a bit, he wasn't the best at the early part of the week.
No.
Was there, can you remember, any discussion of who could, having a replacement on standby? Because I had heard, don't know if this is right or wrong, that Scaife was the man who might have been tabbed given that he was in the Holden family, Gibson Motorsport weren't the strongest team at the time. Of course, they tried to get him to HRT before and they got him there, the next year.
97, yeah.
But, we've seen drivers replaced late at the last moment at various tracks over the years with deals that we never thought were possible. David Bernard driving for Glenn Seaton one year when his car was crashed and a few things like that. Do you remember anything of that, of who might have ever – maybe it never got that far?
It would have been discussed with between Jeff and Creno, for sure, and with other key guys within the group, Robbie Starr and some of the others. But it was never – I was never brought that conversation far. Because if Wally doesn't know, he can't say anything. So there was areas that we made sure I wasn't told things because that way I could say I wouldn't have a clue.
Nothing wrong.
I'm not telling fibbies. Yep. I don't know. Yep. So whether that was or not, I don't know. But, she was an interesting week.
I'll ask MS about that next time.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Not a so 96 is this amazing year. Mm-hmm. You could not. It's fairy tale stuff. You could not have scripted it. It turns out that way. Brock decides in 97 – all right, I'm going to finish up here. So how do you find this out? Did you know that was coming? And then what was the next process when the whole decision
called
was
called into a meeting at Mobil Crenno, Brock, obviously, Jeff, Craig had already gone overseas in 97.
Right. So Murph was the
so Murph's, no, Murph, but I don't think there. He wouldn't have been there. And all Mobile heavies and a few Holden heavies all in the boardroom at Mobile and saying, okay, this is what's going to happen. Brock's going to pull the pin at the end of the season. And we went, oh, okay. So then we had to manage it from there. And so they said, right, you need to do all the relevant press releases and make them available to all of us to bang out from there, and it'll be announced at XX time on XX day, whenever it was. So I thought, how do you write the retirement release for someone like Peter Brock, who you've known, or not known necessarily early doors, but known from as a fan from the late 60s to now working with the guy quite closely for a number of years. How do you write it? And I went, okay, so – and I've got a copy at home somewhere still. I think it was framed of that release. And I sort of did it and changed it and changed it and did it. And, you know, because you're doing Brock quotes. Brock says, oh, da-da-da-da-da. And you think, And then I was like, yeah, that's probably about where we are. So I faxed it up to Bevo and Pete. And I said, could you give me a heads up if I'm in the right direction or whatever changes you think you would like to see made to it, da-da-da-da-da. Fax it off and sort of not like today when you email anything or whatever. Yeah, it's just you faxed. And about an hour or so later, he rings back and he said, that's fine. And Bevo said, yeah, no, that's fine. She said, you've obviously worked with him too long. She said, all the quotes – were that's what it. He would have said.
Yeah.
So, so I thought, well, that's – yeah, I was pretty happy with that. You know, it's just something fairly innocuous in the big scheme of life, but, yeah, but you know, to write something –
it's a historic moment in the sport and you're right there among it.
Yeah, so it was that, and then we went from there and, of course, you know, madness. You know, laps here and laps there and another farewell and, oh, my God. And that just managing that was a nightmare to not to – and not just the racing side of things. So, but yeah, we got there. But then he had about another three or four Dame Nellie Melba comebacks anyway. but yeah, that was the year when trying to get him away from the public. You know, I mean, there's people standing in front of you. They've got cap, jacket, polo, cars, you know, I don't know, cuddly bears, underpants, who knows what. You know, everything is autographed by Brock. Can you sign this? Well, what else do you need signed, for God's sake? Okay, their bedrooms must be interesting.
Yeah. Next topic. Just quickly too, mate, the National Motor Racing Museum at Mount Panorama, good friends of ours, and they've actually got, as we speak, one of the Holden Racing Team Commodores on display up there. The first VT, the car that Craig and Mark drove at Bathurst in 98 that Scafey put on pole, that Murph wheeled out at Calder in the very first time when car 98, remember when that was a brand new car, that's up there at the moment. Just a reminder to our listeners, they're rippers up at the museum. If you're at the mountain or if you're in that part of New South Wales, go and see them. There's always something new, something coming in or out of the place. There's a Larry Perkins exhibition that's been on in recent times with some cool stuff. They're not open Tuesdays. Don't go Tuesdays. Any other day is fine. Check out the opening hours on their Facebook page or the museum's Bathurst website. Well, favourite part of working with Brock, worst part of working with Brock?
Worst part was the crowd management, obviously. You know,
you had to be an asshole, basically.
Yeah. So that was the hardest part of it. Best part is being able to work with a bloke that is one of your heroes. So in other words, you know, as I said, Hume Weir, drunken lunatic up in the hill, going, "Black's pretty bloody good," and that thing, and then following that career through, and then getting a chance to work with them. It's pretty special when you've got someone who's got a reputation like that in this country to be able to work alongside and be a friend, and he was a naturally funny guy, and he was an absolute larrikin, keeping the mad bugger under control. Oh my God. Cut him loose in some areas, mate. Oh, yeah. It's the stories we can't tell.
One day, maybe. Yeah. Maybe. You never know. Speaking of things to manage and big moments in team history in the time that you were there, is the Lowndes rollover at Calder. Massive accident, 1999. divisions well known from the Channel 10 and Barry Sheen nearly dropping an F-bomb as it all skates down the road and all turns to crap. There's probably a few media management things along the way. The pre-Bathurst few years earlier with the baseball cap and that stuff, there was a legality issue at Bathurst in 94 with the strut towers that had a bit of a flame around the industry with it.
You want to bring that on? I'd love to talk about that.
Well, go for it if you like. You know, we're always here to talk. You know, I'm here to listen.
I'm still, all these years later in 2022, still pissed off with that business in 95 with the strut towers.
Mm.
95? 94. 94, sorry.
Yeah. Was that new car that was called Beth. The blokes at Beth. HRT and people associated with the sport love that car. It had such a long
Actually, it's a sidelight because you were talking about chassis numbers and that. Mm. Beth was the one that started because all of a sudden that was the first one that was named.
Yeah, blame Tony Fredrickson.
Fred.
Yeah.
So that was the first one that was given a name. And so all of a sudden then we had to follow it. When somebody else used it, we say, this is like Beth. This is the chassis. So that's when we got chassis numbers, these races, these drivers, da-da-da-da-da. And we did that for all our cars and then you started raping and pillaging all our fresh sheets so that you could create your little empire.
You put it out and I just collected it all.
Anyway,
it's
back to 94. As I said, this is the first year. I said earlier that you know, there's a bit of eggshell stuff because I'm in an area that I'm not totally familiar with. I'm still learning the business. And then some people were not happy that I got the gig. So anyway, when the shit hit the fan at Bathurst on the Thursday, bloody Larry again, he looked at it and he said, something wrong here, cock. And he thought, what were we up to? So he got the scrutineers to look at it and they came in and they went, that car's not legal. And then it turned into a bun fight. And I'm sitting there trying to absorb what's going on, don't understand what they're talking about.
Because they're talking about the shock tower
placement. As we found out later, the top of the McPherson strut tower, you could move them within 20 mil of the radius.
Yeah, there was a tolerance of within X certain.
Yeah, so these have been moved by 18 mil. So
from
it was within the 20,
from
the original standard. Yeah. All right. Now, the media were getting onto this and they're taking an opportunity. Here's Tom Walkinshaw cheating again and that bloody Holden Racing team.
And the other thing I've got to add there too to remember that there was the $100,000 bonus put up for Brock to win his 10th Bathurst that year that had rolled people who – there was 100 grand to win the prize for the race, but he stood to gain another 100. Which was smart race promotion, by the way, the ARDC and the Bathurst City Council and Channel 7. So there was already that backdrop.
Yeah,
to
it was a warm winner. We get 100 grand. Mm. So now over in the media centre, because let's remember we were talking about the media back in the early 90s and there was some of the doyens, shall we say, some of the legends of motorsport, and they expected the world to come to them. Mm. They would not get out of that media centre at all to follow a story. Everyone was to come to them. Mm. So therefore, when this blew up, well, somebody better come in. And the person who wasn't happy, about me having this role, came down and said, you better get over there because, you know, you're getting torn to shreds over there. And I think he was sort of throwing a few coals on the fire, So I think I went over there with, at that stage, Crino, which was bad. I mean, here's me that has no idea and Crino has even less on the technical side of things.
Technical boss.
Yeah, so you're going,
where's Ronnie Harrit when you need him?
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, we didn't put the fire out, but we sort of quelled it for the moment and said, put your matches away, boys, and we'll try and get some more information. So I said, no, righto, Jeff, for God's sake, clue me up here. I don't understand. You should. Ronnie, tell Wally what's going on here with this bloody thing. So thankfully, because Ron's a good guy at explaining things. Now, he's like a Larry, except Larry was better at it, at bending the rules, shall we say. And Ron was pretty good at interpreting them as well. Now, he took the rule where you could move the top of the strut tower within a radius of 20 mil. So you could not exceed 20 mil. Now, what the radius was is where the argument came in because the radius, as far as Ron reading of the rules, is a 360-degree sphere, all right?
Of where it can move to.
Of where it could move to. And he said, well, if I go up with the top of the tower, you're lowering the car by 18 mil and I'm within the 20 millimetre of moving the radius like that. And he said that to the scrutineers and they went, Oh, no, that's not how we understand it.
That's not what we how well,
that's
we
not,
read it.
That's not Larry how Larry understands it. That's not how we understand it. And he said, well, that doesn't matter what you don't understand. If it's not in the rules, I can run it. We can do it. No, you can't do it. But with this stage, I think either Tom was on his way to Australia, was in Sydney on his way to the races, or he was still back in UK. I can't remember which. But Jeff got onto Tom, Crenna got onto Tom, and he's got, what's the rule say? The rule is you can move it within that. And he said, stuff him. He said, I'll take out an injunction. I'll get a bloody injunction. I'll stop the bloody race. And he was willing to do it. Mm. There may have been a point where there wasn't going to be a race on the Sunday because he said, in a court of law, I'm going to win this and I'll make sure I win it. And the ones that buckled were Holden and said, no, you can't do this. You got to do it. So they ended up having to swallow the pride, putting spaces in and letting the thing go out within their interpretation of 18 mil. Mm. And, you know, we were still considered cheats where we just were better readers of the rules. And yet everyone got scared of, you know, what if it went to court and what if, Supreme Court. That would cost a bit, wouldn't it? Supreme Court Saturday morning. Still peed off about that because I think quite legit when you think of some of the other funny things that people have got away with. That one, I reckon, still sticks in my craw, as they say.
I can tell. Mm. So back to Lowndes 99.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
Was that the biggest? I mean, clearly spectacular accident, big accident. By that stage, he's the reigning champion. He's the biggest name in the sport.
And he's come back, yeah.
And he's come back from Europe. He's won the championship. He's leading, I think he was leading by that stage in 99. Yeah. And he goes over on his head down the road and does his knees out for a round, all that sort of stuff. All the media, I mean, at the time, V8 supercars have been on Channel 10 for a couple of years, and I reckon late 90s, early noughties is peak. Oh, mid-noughties probably carried through to there. But that's peak V8 supercars for me in terms of crowds, television, manufacturer backing, sponsorship.
Once Cocker got hold of it.
All that sort of stuff.
Yeah, once Cody Cocker got hold of it.
There were lots of eyes on that incident that happened. Is that the biggest media management situation you've had that you would have had in the whole time there?
It was one of the worst.
Yeah, true.
From the point of view that too many other people got involved in the thing. And that's the part that you can't control the narrative if you don't have control. Mm. Take a couple of steps back. One of the reasons Craig got the gig in the first place is because he was here in Melbourne. Mm. Tom Ash lived on the Gold Coast. Brock was always everywhere. And in those days you didn't have your three test days a year. You can do whatever you like, whenever you like. Mm. And so the boys with everything want to try something. And they put the car, literally put the car on the back of a trailer, go out to Calder and you on a club day. So you pay about $50 for the day. It costs
cheap
you nothing.
Trip
check high. And you run around and you could bet in brakes, you could bet in diffs and gearboxes and all those things and try something and do all that. And they go, okay, you can drive the car. All right, fine. So he'd go out there, drive the little Cortina out. That he built on himself, spear around the track while I told him to do whatever and bed this in, do that, and that. And that went on and on. And then got to the point where, and again, no tyre restrictions. So, Mort, set a good softies for the young bloke for Cooler. Oh, okay, right. So he'd do what he had to do, and then at the end of the day, they'd let him cut loose. Mm. And they'd come in and,
What have we got here?
So that was how he got his start, because he was in Melbourne, and you know, so therefore, if you needed to do something, Craig. If you need an appearance, not Craig. So he was not only good, he was very bloody useful because he was here. Mm. And then we had the championship win, going over to Europe for that year. We're doing the Formula 3 thing, 3000, sorry, and meeting his first wife who went with him.
Yep.
And in my view was always we needed someone to go with him, but not a partner, as it were, because you need to keep the whoever it was focused, because we know what Mr. Marco, Helmut Marco, is like as far as
he's got an interesting history organizing with Australian things. Race drivers as well.
Yes, exactly. Weber, so that didn't work out as well as I want. So then when he came back, where did we move to? We moved to Queensland. So we're not in Melbourne anymore. We've got other influences. coming through on the system there. So then when we had that big crash that day, and I'm just still gobsmacked by that one. Pardon me. I don't think this old body had moved so fast as I ran down that other end of the, to get down to that area. Seen got out of the car. And no, because everyone says, oh, yeah, so-and-so stopped to see if he was all right, so-and-so stopped. Larry stopped to see if he's all right.
And then looked under the car.
No, he didn't. I don't know if he went to Craig. He just sort of was sitting, sitting on his head or whatever he was doing. He's just leaning there looking under the car and going,
Crossmember. Exhaust.
Okay, so then we had the problem was going to take him to hospital and do all that and get the diagnosis and that. And then I'm trying to control it. Crino's involved as well because people he knows at 9 or 7 or whatever.
Because everyone wants a piece of the story.
Yeah, so I know John Crennan and I'm high enough up in the echelon here that I'll make a phone call. And so all of a sudden there's all these things. I mean, I was so pissed off that somebody allowed Channel 9 to stick a microphone in him in a hyperbaric chamber.
That day, that night?
Like within the next day or so. You know,
which they're used to doing that in footy door stopping land. Mm. That's their world.
Yeah. And me, it was, we need to control this, but other people were giving approval for things to do. Mm. And I'm just off my tree with the thing. And you could tell it wasn't the beginning of the end, but it was became difficult to deal with because of the outside influences. On Craig, and then those outside influences eventually got to the point where it was you'll get better looked after elsewhere and da 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 and eventually that 00 racing thing came into being, which wasn't all that successful when you think about it, but that was there was the influences that sort of tended to I said start that little fracture process, but it obviously took another couple of years. 2 or 3 years after that, but that was the start of it all. With all that, it was not a good time at all. I mean, dreadful crash, did all that. If we could continue to manage it in the way we normally would, it probably would have been fine. But it was just you end up being sort of barriered out of it, and I was really annoyed by that.
As history shows, he missed a round, he came back, and he still bloody won the championship, which, you know, I don't think anyone's missed a round quite like that and been able to do it. Wing Cup actually did miss a round in New Zealand some years later and still managed to go and win. But So Lowndes leaves at the end of 2000. Obviously, Scaife's arrived. He's been there for a few years. Mm-hmm. There's a theory that Scaife's the political animal and he pushes Lowndes out. But tends to be that Lowndes has kind of changed his life a bit. He goes to Queensland. I remember that there was a story somewhere that he's rung to find out, the day that Glenn Seaton had his really big crash, Craig wasn't there because he wasn't testing because, as you said, he's in Queensland. Scaife's Melbourne. We're Melbourne. We'll just go and go. We won't take him with us. So the chat gets back.
Whispers in air. Yeah.
And away that stuff goes. So I remember being at Motorsport News in that year of 2000. It was my first year there, actually, out of school. And the day that the press release lobbed to say Craig Lowndes is leaving the Holden Racing team, there'd been murmurs, there'd been chat. Jeff Pilates, the late Ford boss, had said, we'd be interested to talk to him.
What, and he hadn't been?
And clearly there was a big checkbook there to go throw around, as came out in the court documents a few years later with the 00 stuff. Could you believe that this had happened? Like, this was from where it was a couple of years earlier to now this kid, we call him the kid, but, you know, the guy that had won a bunch of championships, the media darling, the biggest name in the sport with the fan base, is leaving the biggest team. It's one of the biggest news stories in the category's history. You were among it all. How did it all play out in your world?
You knew there was... Yeah, you know, I alluded to the outside interests. There's a lot of people in his ear.
And we're talking managers, lawyers, advisors, family.
Family and outside advisors. We probably didn't know really well at that stage who they were, but there was a lot of people whispering in his ear
that you'll get a better deal somewhere else.
You're getting stitch up. Yeah. And I remember at the 2000 was the last year, wasn't it?
Yep.
At Bathurst 2000, at the back at where we stayed at Mount Panorama. We always had
the college down the road.
The barbecue and what have you, and we were beers, chops, sausages, a whole box of dice, enjoying it. But there was this vibe going on. And I thought, there's Creno, Tom and Craig. And Tom and Creno doing it. Tom and Craig doing a lot of sort of over in the background having a chat. We'll keep on this, but we'll keep everything bubbling along. We're all having a nice time. And the end of it, Tom was by himself and I walked over and said, get you anything, Tom? You want a beer or anything? I said, no, Wally. He said, you know what? He said, I can't believe I've offered that lad more money than I've ever offered anyone before and he's knocked me back. I thought, okay. So therefore, you knew there was something else on the table.
Because he'd announced before Bathurst that year that he was leaving. So we knew he was leaving, but where was he going and what was happening?
I don't know. I'm so contemplating my future. If you're knocking back the sort of dollars that Tom was talking about,
you know where you're going.
You know where you're going. Mm. So that's the part that I suppose that frustrated me out of the thing that was, once they get out of controls outside your influence by moving into state, you're susceptible to outside influences whispering in short pink ears. And I think that's what happened.
Mm.
And it didn't for the first few years until he tied up with Triple Eight. What did it deliver? Nothing.
Not a great deal. Lots of money, but not many wins.
Lots of money.
So Scaife goes on a roll. The Red Barons era begins, 2000 to 2002. Of course, things change at the start of 2003, but that's the golden little period there where they became red cars. Then, because they'd never been red before that, but then they were fully red at that point.
That was a funny one. That was sent back because when HRT first started, its first sponsor was what's now called Telstra,
But
Telecom Mobile Net.
Yeah, that's where the 015 came from. Yeah.
Correct. So Telstra's colours were blue, so we became a blue team.
Very dark blue, but still blue.
Because the first one was black in the 1990 car. That was a black. rear quarter, and then it came to this Telstra or Telecom Mobile Net blue, and then slowly we sort of added red bits through it, little flames and highlighters on the Holden HRT helmet and all that sort of stuff, and then I know it wasn't at Holden. But it must have been about that 99-2000 era when Scaife came on board with someone to hold and went, we're the red team, why aren't we red? Bloody good point, that.
Let's be red.
Oh, let's be red. And so they just bounced when they came out red. And then we had the full red kit as well. We used to be very conservative in our blue tops, light blue tops and dark blue pants and all that, all very, very corporate and that sort of thing. And then when we came out with that year, the first year red, and said to the guys, here's your kit, lads. It's a red shirt and black trousers. Oh, good. For Saturday. What do you mean for Saturday? On Sunday, it's the red shirt and the red strides and the red fearless runners. And they went, oh, I'm wearing that shit. But they did, and proudly.
Part of a winning team. Walk tall, doesn't matter what colour your pants are.
Yeah, Those red runners used to sail around the plane on the way back from Tassie and all sorts of things. Oh, God. Good fun.
How did you see that Scaife era where he became the champion 3 years in a row and, Craig left and, he was unstoppable. That was his top peak of his career. He had some great times at Nissan. But from your position, was that he was so dominant. It was unbelievable.
I think, when all the planets align and all that sort of stuff, but he certainly was – very driven. We had a bunch of guys that were the same. We had compliant bosses that wanted to make that happen. So really, it all sort of melded together. And what he bought was that it's that slightly more professional bent. We're professional We were really focused on it, but he just seemed to bring everyone with him to make it a little bit more. And I mean, when he first was mooted to be arriving, some blokes weren't happy.
Was it true that there were blokes who threatened to leave?
Yeah, because they said, well, why do you think we got out of
Gibson's?
Gibson's, because they didn't like working with Mark. And Jeff was going, oh, geez, Crenna, you're kidding, aren't you? Escaping, yeah.
Because he was ex-Gibson.
He was in Gibson's.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I think you'll find the guy's different because he's not in that same sphere because he's a driver, but he'll have holding capabilities, contract stuff. But he's not in that sort of quasi-management mix-up, if you like, there was a Gibson of us, but Fred and Mark were sort of almost, you know, joint managers to a certain extent. And they said, I think, so I'm thinking, oh, I mean, I've known Scafie for a while, for a long time, but I'd never worked with him, so I didn't know what to expect. So I'm getting a little bit coloured by what I'm hearing from the workshop floor. And then when he came in, and give Scafie, he's a smart boy. And he knows. So basically he walked in day one of the place, walked straight and drove straight into the workshop, if you don't mind. Thank you very much. Opened the boot, slabs.
Mm. The international currency of all happy mechanics everywhere.
Absolutely. And I went, oh, yeah, go on your mark, thank you. And he would, and he's almost the only driver that's ever done it, you know that? And he did do it. He would turn up on Friday if he wasn't interstate or doing something else, but he'd basically turn up most Friday afternoons and he'd walk in with a slab, bang. Mm. In the kitchen, right, boys, down tools, beer time. And they go, oh, okay, fine. So he'd learnt himself. As much as we'd learnt, he'd learnt that we if we worked on a cuddle process and we all put our arms around each other, and so therefore he was now one of the boys. Mm. So, oh, this is the Clayton crew. Mm. No, here we go. Mm. So yeah, we have beers with blokes. And he went to after race meetings. But if you went to the airport to get a – waiting for a plane to come back, he'd buy beers. Mm. He'd get people into, you know, Qantas Club, all that sort of stuff. So he was really good at helping to not so much motivate guys, but bring them all together. Bring them all together and make them feel you know, worthwhile and wanted.
Yeah.
And that's basically what anyone likes in a working, you know, in a working situation is being felt that you're important. Mm. And let's pretty face simple. It, those guys are pretty important.
Yeah, totally. Without them, you ain't winning any races, that's for sure.
The work they do.
Yeah, big time, big time. 2000 Bathurst. You got dragged in to see Tim Schenken in race control, did you? It's never very good when that happens, Wal. So am I right in my understanding of this? And I think you may have told this story in the Australian Muscle Car Mag that you write a column in. But you were summoned over the loudspeaker to race control.
Yeah.
Tim, of course, the race director, has been up until the end of last year. You can take up the story, but it was because one of your team members, who wasn't a full-timer, but at Bathurst you injected some extra people because it was a big event, had been given a task, I think, by Jeffo, because there was a requirement for some more mirrors, driver-side, passenger-side mirrors. Yep. So it was sort of felt that, well, we're the Holden racing team, there's Holdens in the car park that are Holdens, we'll borrow some.
Hmm.
Sounded like a good theory, but what happened then?
Yeah, well, that was the year 2000 was horrendously wet.
Oh, yeah. I'm still drying out from it.
Yeah, horrendously wet. I mean, and the Plato, Andy Prio, et cetera.
Plato and Muller. That was that year, wasn't it?
Yeah,
that's right.
They are mad buggers. They are mad
Probably
buggers.
Can't tell some of those stories.
Would I pick them up from the airport in Bathurst, I think, on the airport on the Wednesday? And they said, Sedalia, take us around the track. I don't think I'll get it on the track. And they said, oh, we want to go up on this hill that we've heard about, you see. And it's thundering now with rain. And so we've drawn past at turn one and where you start driving up the hill. And we got up there and there's sort of a gate-ish area, you know. And there was, if you like, it was like, what's that walk? Yeah, Walking Dead type thing. It was like they're just sort of standing there and the rain's running off them.
Why are we here?
Who are you and what are you doing here? You know, and they both went, nah, fucking, let's get out of here. Went back down again. So they were there. So they were characters. But as soon as you got the cars on the track with that much rain and water, your visibility, because they're pigs of things anyway, visibility was non-existent inside the car. So the boys have got obviously an interior rear vision mirror and they had a driver's side wing mirror and they're pretty small things. And never had a left-hand We'd never had left-hand rear mirrors, left-hand or passenger side wing mirrors at that point. And they said, we just can't see. If anyone's coming down, you're there with all the spray and everything. And can we get, you know, wing mirrors? Suppose. I suppose we can. So just gone. Got any mirrors in the truck? No, not wing mirrors.
We don't use them.
No, we don't use them. Oh, yeah. And then he had the brilliant idea. It was because Holden used to supply all the support cars, and they were red Commodore wagons. And he got wing mirrors on them.
Spare parts.
So he sent out Shane Hill, I'll name him, one of our engine guys, and Shane's a bit of a hobbit, you know, and never really came outside his engine area. But this year he went to Bathurst and he's there. And Shane, can you? Oh, yeah, what? So Shane went up there with a screwdriver and what have you, and went up there and started butchering removing wing mirrors. And with that, he was approached by this very urbane gentleman saying, "I say, what are you doing?" He said, "My job." "What's your job?" And he said, "Oh, somebody needs these. My boss needs these, so I'm removing them." He said, "Do you know who I am?" He says, "No." Oh, okay. So he said, "Yeah, why don't you F off and let me get more of the job?" So Shane just continued to doing it, ignoring him totally, sitting there, rain dropping, falling off him everywhere, and apparently Tim's gone back. Next thing, I've got the call. "Would Paul Weissel from the Holden Racing team please report to Tim Schenken's office?" What's this all about? I walked in there.
This is not a good sign.
I walked in and he told me, and he said, "One of your lads just told me to F off." I said, "Well, he possibly had a very good reason, Tim. What was it?" And then he told me about the episode. I said, that'd be right, man. "Well, he doesn't know you, Tim." Well, I said, "With great respect, but he doesn't know you." I said, "He doesn't go to race meetings very often." I said, "He had a miserable job in pouring rain. Was asked by Jeff to get these mirrors off because we need to put them on the race cars. The Holden supplied the cars. Spoke to Steve over at Holden. He said, no worries." So he said, "That's what he was doing." So nice for it. A bit more respect, but yeah, okay, whatever, Tim. So that was fine. I was called up there once early doors in probably about 94 or 95 by Ivan Stibbard and Mike Raymond.
Oh.
I got summoned there.
Oh.
And they I don't know what though. I think it was they said something, I think it was to do with like cameras in cars.
Yeah.
And at that stage we were anti-cameras in cars because people basically came along and cut a hole in your car and put a camera in. And so Jeff said, "It's not happening." And it might have been something to do with that. And I was summoned there and they told me to sit down and the two of them standing over me like this. So I immediately got out of the chair and standing up with them and folded the arms. I go, "What is it, Phyllis?" So there's a lot of those power games going on. All good fun.
True. Now, what wasn't good fun was the start of 03 because that's when TWR collapses overseas. Been so well written about, known about thing. The team gets, you know, basically the Clayton Empire gets divided because of the ownership stuff, and Scaife gets HRT. There's Keys Wheels involved. The Kellys get involved later on down the track. There's, you know, all the bits and pieces are flying around everywhere. Was that kind of where it never was the same after that? It was a different world. And did that kind of great to, because you left, I think, 04 after that. So
middle of 04.
Was that sort of the start of the end for you, that it wasn't quite the same?
It wasn't the same. So, yeah. Mm. I mean, the great thing about the time we'd had there, the 9 years or whatever it was that we were totally independent. People had some semblance of control or control over you as far as, you know, from a Holden point of view sort of thing, but you didn't work for Holden.
No, which a lot of fans probably don't quite understand.
You
and if anything, the greatest rivalry around was Holden v HRT, really. I mean, it sounds a bit strange, but there was certain factions within Holden and Holden Motorsport who were against, because, again, Crenno had put the big fence up around HRT and that was that. So that was it. There was this bit of a cold war between the two.
There was that divide, but we could basically thumb our noses to an extent. I mean, you weren't rude, but basically, well, that's the way we're doing it. I mean, from one of the posters we did, it might have been, I think it was 96 poster, team poster that we did. I said to Crenna, "Oh, I'd like to do a poster." Yeah. Yeah. And I wanted that aero from where we are, you know, the old Nissan bodyworks thing there. I said, then I want to have the race truck. And I said to Jeff, too, and I looked at myself, the race truck, merchandising truck, race car drivers, all the team. What do I do that for? I said, make a bloody good poster.
I reckon I've got it somewhere, actually.
I'm sure you have. Yeah. And so the boys don't never like that sort of thing. But, you know, and how long is it going to take? I said, most of the day. Oh, what?
That's prep time. Car prep time.
So I had Graham Neander to come down and we set the thing up and how we could do it. And, we can do that. And I need the truck here and that and the car there. And I need that thing with the Allen shock absorber thing. I want it. And I need that bit over there and that bit. And we dressed the whole thing like that. And then Graham had to light it. And we had to get guys in to light that area. And then they'd wander off and try to come out. Mate, that place was so big. We were playing kick to kick just down in the thing. And so I don't know what that cost. I was never on a budget. I just did it. And we made the normal posters that we distribute at the racetracks. And then we had the big A3s, which the guys laminated, they butchered, they cut up, they put hair on somebody else and then no hair on me. And with us. So they loved it, in other words, right?
Yeah.
But we were independent. All right. I didn't run to a budget. If I wanted to do something, I just did it.
And
it just made it happen. All of a sudden, Tom goes tits up. Now, Creno was smart. He could see that there was potentially problems. So a year or so before, apparently, I had no idea, he got HSV out of the TWR umbrella into a separate company. So when TWR bit the dust, HSV didn't. It was still going. However, HRT was still part of TWR Group. So therefore, when Formula One arrows went bust, so did we. So then what are we going to do? So we got called down to Corinna, said, this is what's happened, da-da-da-da-da. And so then we had to start managing it from there. He said, I don't know who's going to be the owner. He said, or bosses or anything. He said, we should work it. So the white knight coming out of the hills on his big charger, Holden said, we bought HRT. Couldn't buy HRT,
which is actually against the category rules.
Correct,
that because the manufacturer.
And they said we're just doing it. They said we're just doing it of the goodness out of our heart. We will sell it, but we need to get it out of the hands of the receivers over in the UK. They were willing to take I don't know how much just to get that one off their books. They didn't have to worry about it, and that's Australia to worry about. What the hell? So Holden, the heroes. Here we go. Look what we've done. We've saved HRT. It wasn't until later. Yes, they did. Yes, they did. They wanted to. But you know, referring earlier about stuff like T-shirts and hats and things like that. When the original contract was done, the TWR Australia was able to use the Holden logo.
Right? To therefore put on shirts and caps. And
there was no such thing as merchandising. But, you can add a letterhead and I'm thinking, whatever. So then this behemoth comes along that's turning over 20 mil a year, and Hull's going, huh? What? So they've been at Creno since about 99, 2000 to go, we want that back. You can't. It's in the contract, see? Yeah, it's ours. So spend $1 million, save HR. I don't know how much it was cost them to get out of the TWR problems in the UK, but say it's $1 million. So it's $2 million. Who cares? I mean, what are the returns? They're fairly good. They're fairly good. And then you do an on-sell to Scaife, to Keys Wheel and to the Kellys. But then us that worked there didn't know who we were working for because the Holden Motorsport thing is that we became basically then subcontracted ourselves, however all that worked, back to where the Scaifes or the Kellys or the Wheels. And you had no idea who you really worked for or who had control over you or who could ask you to do things. And all that independence and fun that you had was blown apart. And all of a sudden, if I wanted something, I had to go and have it budgeted and costed and things like this. And then, we'll supply this and we'll supply that. And you go, geez. And it just lost.
It just got hard.
I mean, had Tom not gone bust, I'd probably be still there sweeping the floors or walking people around the museum aspect of
time. This is the trophy we won in 2002.
But it just it wasn't fun there. So when my wife and the fact after 10 years when I think I worked out that we're away for whatever reason for 20 or 30 weekends or weeks, parts of the week of the year.
Heads up.
And then after a while, and that stage, the kids were quite young, and Sandra was stuck at home with three smalls, and then she got me in this weak moment and said, why don't we do this? And I enjoyed the 11 years of doing something thoroughly outside the square in the fruit and veg thing, but was never going to be a success. It wasn't a huge success. I didn't lose money at it. Didn't make money. And so I learned a lot.
You guys went and set up a fruit and veg shop.
Yeah. It just seemed like a good idea at the time. And that probably shows how disillusioned you'd become with something that had been so much part of your life, and you were part of this awesome thing, and then it became a fragment of what it used to be, and you just went, so what's going to happen now in a year from now or 18 months or 2 years? You're going to say, why have we got this toss bag here, this PR guy that's costing us X number of dollars a year when we can save money? And you're going to say, well, you're going to get elbowed anyway because it's not what it was.
Yeah.
Because you don't have the cushion of having TWR and the market with the merchandising and everything that goes with it to go, yeah, whatever, let's just keep on going. So that's when it all came to an end.
But you did make one little comeback because PB came back. 2004? Later that year, remember that he drove with Plato in the Enduros?
Yeah.
So you'd left, I think, earlier that year, but they went, July. Come on, another couple of rounds. No. They squeezed a couple more out of you, didn't they? Or were you still there?
No.
Oh, no, I thought you'd left.
I went in June. My last meeting was the
– Queensland Raceway?
Was that horrible Queensland Raceway place, Paperclip.
Don't tell Tony Quinn that, jeez. He runs it now, so.
Well,
he's painted it, and the toilets are looking good from what I've seen.
Look, John Tetley, I wish him well with that thing because, you know, that thing's been a blight on the motor racing industry from the day before it was designed. So hopefully it will become better, but it should never have been built.
Don't start me about how they got the 500 from Sandown. That's a whole other story.
Yeah.
So the fruit and veg, what are you doing now? You ran the shop for a while. What are you doing now?
Yeah, we got out in 2015, and I sat around for a few months, and then one of the guys I knew through the fruit and veg said, can you come and work for me in doing some wholesale work for me? And I've been working on and off for them since then. At the moment it's on after all the lockdowns of doing nothing.
Yep.
We need a new knee, which they've recently restarted elective surgery, so hopefully I might be a bit more springy on thing. But, yeah, so physically that's a work in progress at the moment, but everything else-wise I'm having a great time. And, would I go back tomorrow? Probably. is it as good as it was? No. We don't have manufacturer allegiance anymore, so we've got to now focus our support, probably like F1 a little bit, on drivers.
Which was going that way for a fair while anyway through the company. Yeah. So a couple of quick ones before we go. Is Walkinshaw Andretti United your team? Do you still follow what was the HRT? Is that your team?
The screensaver on my computer at home is always every year the Walkinshaw or Walkinshaw Andretti United car of the year. That's every year. As soon as the new one's out, hang it's on, that's my screensaver. So, yes, it's always the same.
Yep.
And after, like Bathurst last year, other times I'll send a little note to them, whether they get through to the guys or through to Ryan and Martin, I don't know. But, yeah, we send a little, well done. Yeah,
there's still plenty of guys that are in that team that were there back in the day.
Yeah, I think I went to Sandown about 3 or 4 years ago. And spent the weekend there, and just to say good day to a few kids kept in the background. With Todd Kelly went, oh, good day, Wal, how are you? Good to see you. And I went, good day, Ricky. He went, yeah, hello, Mick. He hadn't any idea who I was because he didn't even bother looking over his shoulder. But Todd was good fun.
One of our partners who advertised with us is the motorsporttrader.com. They keep motorsport memories alive. While they deal in race car parts, they deal in race suits, they deal in all sorts of stuff from over the years. You can check out their website, the motorsporttrader.com. They've got some cool stuff, which segues, what have you kept from your red days? Have you still got some red pants? What are your keepsakes from your time with the whole racing team?
I've got a team shirt from every year.
Yep.
Signed. drivers.
But, and, I was going to say, what, by you?
Yeah, right. by drivers and the crew. As I said, you know, it wasn't just the drivers and the whole crew. Yeah. So I've got a shirt from each of the years. I don't think I got the red pants because for one of my sons thought, they're really cool, Dad. And don't wear those out. Whatever you do, you toss back. And one of the other ones wore the red shoes until they didn't work anymore. I still got a scaife jacket, you know, when Mark had his own scaife jacket when we were doing HSV stuff. And I've got a race team jacket and caps and things all the way in there. And I've got, when I left, the guys got a whole heap of pertinent photos, posters, etc., and had them all framed for me. And I've got those at home, and including the Brock one, which is signed by Brock. And there's a shot, there's one shot or photo print that's got a photo of every one of the cars from the time I was there and every one of the drivers. And I'm pretty much all signed. Well, couldn't get Brock's signature for some unknown reason. Yeah. No, that was 2004, wasn't it? So, I did. So I got everyone's signature on it, picture of the cars and drivers on that one. So they're pretty nice things to have. They're not on the wall or anything. They're just sitting in the corner. But they're there. And with the, as I said, with the team kit as well.
You still bleed red, Wal.
We still bleed red. Actually got a red car. The trouble is it's a Kia Rio.
Red is red. Red is red. Hey, quickly, too, last one before we go. Will it ever be revealed? Your eyebrows have gone up at this. Who drove the car that did the burnouts at Eastern Creek that got a 10 grand fine for the team and Scafie and Jason Bright point penalties? We know who it was.
Yes.
I've never named and shamed. You've never named and shamed. No one's ever named and shamed. Will someone name and shame the person who did that one day?
I think he should do it himself one day. Yeah, I mean, you've been spoken about that much over the years and you cost us that much money.
Yeah.
You should do it yourself.
It's pretty rough that drivers who had nothing to do with something got pinged 30 points.
Yeah.
That's a bit rough.
That was rude. That was another night I spent outside buddy Cam's office. I had a few of those. I was sitting at Cam's office, you know. Oh, God, you know. You go in there, can we sit in? No, said himself. No, you can't. But why? I said, I'm just observing. No. Close out you get. You're only the PR person. Out you get. Yeah. Jeff used to send me up to, before that, in an internet or email thing, when someone did something on the track. Wally, get up and tell that Schenken, that idiot so-and-so, did my driver off the track, Excuse me, Tim, Jeff would like to bring to your attention that, so we don't do that anymore, but that was always good fun.
Yeah, these days it's a bit boring because teams just sit there on their computers garages and send a message up there on the LAN and someone gets it in race control and probably deletes it half the time for what they complain about. But things have changed, but one thing that hasn't changed is that's a golden era of the Holden Racing team. So while... Thanks for sitting down with us and having a bit of a chat about it and driving down memory lane. You've got a column in Australian Muscle Car Magazine and we're great friends with the guys at AMC, so keep on reading that to our listeners as well, because I'm sure there's a few more stories that you haven't quite let out of the bag.
There's a few.
Just yet.
Might be a bit more editorialised than the funny ones, because I think there's a few things that need to be head kicked at the moment.
Right, some head kicking coming. All right, we'll keep an eye on AMC. Right. Walt, thank you so much.
Thank you. Old people like talking about the past, so I've appreciated the opportunity.
That's what we're all about. A big thank you to Paul Weissel. It was great to catch up with Walt, who came into Sleuth headquarters to sit down and talk stories about the Holden Racing team. It's been great to have these run over the last 2 weeks. Jump on our website, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. Don't miss out. Pre-order the Holden Racing Team book now that documents all of the cars from 1989 to 2016. Second edition book. It is a must-have collectible hardcover, 400 pages, individually numbered. You must add it to your collection if you're a HRT fan. It will be out very soon. Subscribe to our newsletter through the V8 Sleuth website too, so you get the latest. We put out a couple of newsletters every week with links to stories and to new products. Follow us on the socials, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Get in touch with us too. Tell us what you like about the pod. Tell us who you'd like to hear about in the future, or a particular topic you might like us to tackle. We are open ears to all of that. Don't forget too, every Tuesday it is the Castrol Motorsport News Podcast. Subscribe so you don't miss an episode for the latest of news and views and opinions of Australian and world motorsport. And every Thursday, Repco Supercars Weekly. I'll be with you to bring the latest in news and notes and quotes from the Repco Supercars Championship. Right, that's us done for another week. Thanks for joining us on the V8 Sleuth Podcast powered by Repco. I'm Aaron Noonan. We'll chat to you again, same time, next week.